Take your Bibles, please, and turn to the book of Esther. Esther chapter 4. Tonight we're just going to kind of look over the book and give you some information that I think will help you as we begin the study. Esther chapter 4 and verse 14. This, of course, is when Mordecai asked her to make an appeal to the king. And she says that could be life-threatening, and it could have been. And he answers, verse 14, "For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place." I love his faith. It's going to happen. The question is, Esther, whether you want to be a part of it or not. "But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" We've entitled the series, "For Such a Time as This." God's name never appears in the book. It's an interesting part about the book of Esther. His name does not appear there. But his life, his will, I guess we should say, is in every decision. You can see his hand on every life and the working that's moving there. Matter of fact, it's impossible to study the book of Esther and not see the sovereignty of God. It's all over the book. It's very interesting. The Jews hold this book in such high esteem as to assign it a rank next to that of the Pentateuch. That'll tell you how valued they believe the book of Esther is. We don't know exactly when the book was written. The timeline of the book is between 483 BC and 473 BC, so about 10 years of time. And if you want to put it somewhere in the Bible, almost everybody agrees that it's between the 6th and the 7th chapter of the book of Ezra. So you're reading Ezra, between that 6th and 7th chapter, you plug in the book of Esther right there. That's what's happening in the chronology of the Word of God. We don't really know exactly when it was written, neither do we know to whom it was written. In other words, it doesn't have a specific target audience necessarily that we can point to and say, this is to whom it was written. The theme, as we've already mentioned, as a number of authors said, one, the sovereign accomplishment of God's purposes through ordinary people and apparent coincidences. Though he remains invisible, he is in no way indifferent. Our searching the mind of God is little like a minnow surveying the ocean, one author said. We can't figure out all that God's doing, but he is definitely working. The writer of the book, we really don't know either. Some have surmised it was Ezra, some Nehemiah. Most probably lean towards Mordecai being the author, though we really don't know that for sure. The Jewish people believe that it was the high priest Jehoiakim, the son of Joshua. But again, we don't have any internal evidence that points to that. Whoever he was, he knew his Jewish culture very well, and he also knew Persian culture very well. And he blended those pretty amazingly in this book. He probably was an eyewitness of the events that took place, which would eliminate some people there for sure. The purpose of the book, the theme of the book obviously is the sovereignty of God. But the purpose of the book really is to encourage God's people and to give the background of the Feast of Purim, which is the feast that comes into being as a result of the events of this text. And that feast is really quite the feast. The Word of God doesn't say a lot about it. But if you study some Jewish websites and things like that, and they talk about the feast, it's pretty amazing. The book is read every year, most of the time in devout Jewish homes. It's read twice. It's read right on the eve of Purim, and it's read during Purim as well. It's a huge celebration. Now, this year's feast was February the 28th and March the 1st of 2018. That's when Purim took place. Number of things that I thought was really interesting about this today. One website, a Jewish website, said there is a spirit of liveliness and fun at Purim. that is unparalleled on the Jewish calendar. If there were ever a day to let loose and just be Jewish, this is it. Matter of fact, it was interesting on a one site, there was a guy asking questions, and he basically said, how come this is such a big party? And this rabbi goes into this huge explanation of why it's a big deal that we just have fun on this day. So it's kind of interesting how they celebrate that. In addition to the miracle of Jewish survival, despite the efforts of our enemies, Purim celebrates God's intimate involvement. By the way, if you go to Jewish websites, it's really neat. When they spell out the word God, they don't spell it all out. It's G-D because they're afraid to write the name of God. And that this was all through this particular article as well. And that Purim proclaims God's intimate involvement in every aspect of the world. Even though there were no overt miracles recorded in the Megillah, indeed, his name is not even mentioned once. But God was active, pulling the strings to care for his nation. Then one little fun part of one of the websites that I went to was the significance of Purim in modern-day Israel. And this is what they claim. And, of course, everything you read on the Internet is true, so, of course, we believe it. But this seemed to be verifiable. In the early 1950s, Joseph Stalin, the ruthless butcher of millions of innocent people, had bloody plans for dealing with the Jewish problem in the USSR. He was planning to deal with them. Just as things reached the crisis point in 1953, he died. He died on Purim. Interesting. They celebrate that as a miracle, by the way. In 1990, Saddam Hussein of Iraq defiantly invaded nearby Kuwait. As pressure ramped up from the international community, his army began firing Scud missiles into Israel. If you were alive at that time, you remember that very well. The rabbi, and I have no idea how to say his name, I'm not even going to try, okay, but it's a big one, repeatedly assured the people of Israel that they would be protected. After the U.S.-led forces attacked Iraq, they were quickly victorious, and the hostilities ended on Purim. And they have a list of other things that happened significantly connected to the deliverance of the Jews in the Feast of Purim. So this book gives us the background of why that feast is significant, and it also talks about the incredible sovereignty of God. What I love about the book, there's lots that I love about the book, but one of the things that's really interesting is the people of the book of Esther were by and large disobedient people. Now, don't miss this. There had already been an opportunity for Jews to head back to the homeland, which God had commanded them to do. And this group of Jews refused to do it. They didn't go back. All right? And what's interesting about that is even in the midst of their disobedience, God in his sovereignty was still protecting them. I love that about our God in that process. So let's look at a couple of things tonight, again, just by way of introduction. First off, let's look at the characters. And there are some characters, aren't they, in this book, for sure. Of course, we have King Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes, the Greek name. He was Persian. It's interesting, though people have attacked the book in some ways, there's quite a bit of outside evidence when connected to this book that goes, oh, you're kidding. For instance, outside sources confirm that he had a large harem, he had large or excessive drinking parties, and he had an irrational temper. All three of those we see, by the way, in the book of Esther. We see all three of those actually in chapter 1 of the book of Esther, which is kind of interesting that history says that's who he was, and the Word of God does as well. Bible scholars believe that part of what took place to start the book of Esther and why he was in a bad mood and was throwing a party to try to get things going, and it was quite a party, wasn't it? It was a months and months long party. When you read the decorations of this place,
Wow.
I mean, they went all out. You're talking about awards banquet. Man, this was over the top, right? I mean, it was incredible. But many believe that the reason he did that is because he had shortly before had a disastrous military campaign in which he invaded Greece and had miserably failed. And pulling out of that, he's trying to kind of recover everything for that. This also could, by the way, be the reason in chapter 10, it mentions specifically that he levied a tax against the people. Most believe that he was trying to recover the enormous losses of that Greek invasion and what happened there. Just kind of give a historical context of what's taking place in the book. So we have the king. Then we have the Jews. They're mentioned 50 times in 10 short chapters in this book. So they're a critical role play in this. And of course, they are the ones that did not return to the land. You have Vashti. She is the deposed queen. She's only on the scene for a few short verses, and then she's poof, she's gone out of there, which really sets the whole story. She's not an insignificant character at all. Her primary offense in the eyes of the men was a lack of respect and the potential emboldenment of her actions to other ladies in the kingdom. And so therefore, we will deal with her. We'll teach her not to do that. And to teach our other wives, you don't mess with us either. That's basically chapter 1 laid out. That's what was happening. It was a matter of respect. Which, by the way, ladies, will tell you how important men view respect. That's another message. You'll have to come Sunday morning for that. We're in 1 Peter chapter 3, ladies. Sorry. We'll deal with 1 through 6, and then we'll get the men the next week, Lord willing. All right. The fourth character is Haman. As one person put it, he's the villain of the story. He's a wicked anti-Semitic officer. He hates the Jews and plots to take them out. And of course, we know, those of you that are familiar with the book, you know the rest of it. Mordecai is also a significant character. He's the cousin of Esther, but an older cousin that eventually takes care of her. Her mom and dad are killed. We don't know exactly when that took place or what the circumstances were for there. And then, of course, we have Esther herself, which is the book is named after. Esther was her Persian name. Hadassah was her Jewish name. And her Persian name, Esther, means star. And, of course, she becomes a central character in what's taking place. And the providence of God and all that is working through her. So those are the characters of the story. Quickly, let's look just briefly at the city. Because it's a central part of what's taking place. Everything in the story, the central part of everything in the story takes place in and around Shushan the palace. We do know that Jews defend themselves in other regions, but the story that we really have before us, it's also sometimes called Susa or S-U-S-A, and it was the winter palace of the Persian kings. Both Daniel and Nehemiah ministered in this palace. Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 1, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Echaliah, and it came to pass in the month Chislu, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the palace. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 2, and I saw in a vision, it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan, the palace. So both these men were involved in this palace. So biblically, this palace is a pretty critical thing. And when you add Nehemiah, Daniel, and the story of Esther all in there, it becomes a pretty central part of it. Number three, what about the content of the book? And I just want to, we're not going to read the whole book tonight, but I just want to quickly survey, just very, very quickly, the book. In chapter one, I think we see both a revelry and defiance. The king throws a party, an elaborate party, a long party. There was quite a thing taking place there. And of course, in the midst of that party, he asks Vashti to come as his queen and show off her beauty. She refuses. That sets off the story that's taking place here, and that's all led out through here. In chapter 2, we see both replacement and deliverance. Esther the queen is eventually replaced. And then we also see that Mordecai delivers the king from a plot. If you didn't know the rest of the story, you'd wonder why in the world was that even put there, because it's just stuck in chapter 2 until we get later in the story. That becomes a really critical part of what's happened in the story. So we see both replacement, Esther's replaced, and the deliverance of the king. In chapter 3, we see respect and destruction. Haman is lifted up to a position of authority there. And we know that everyone gives obeisance to him. They bow before him, except Mordecai. He's not going to bow before him. Lord willing, deal with some of that a little bit later on. And of course, it is in chapter 3 that Haman lays the plot to destroy all the Jews. Not just Mordecai, but destroys every one of them. And the letters go forth, and it's kind of done. Okay, the seal's been done. That's what's going to happen. In chapter 4, we see both remorse and determination. As Mordecai is brokenhearted when he reads the decree. Not only would he be killed, but every Jew that's left in the kingdom. I mean, we don't know how many total there were, but there would have been thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them. And of course, they're going to die as a result of that. But Mordecai is determined to do something about it. And this is where he then confronts Esther, and he begins the process. It's kind of a neat thing back and forth, because at the time, at least, not everyone in the palace understood the relationship. So he's got on sackcloth and ashes, and Esther sends him a change of clothes, and he said, nope, not going to do that. And she's like, no, you have to. No, I'm not. You know, and this back and forth, and the poor servant guy that's running back and forth, and she said, you got to do this. And, no, do you tell her I'm not going to do this? Okay. He said he's not going to do this. I mean, that you kind of, I don't know, I love to see pictures, right? In the Bible, it's like, this is kind of unfolding with this. And of course, by the end, Esther says, okay, I'll do what you've asked me to do. Let's fast. By the way, part of the Jewish ceremony for those who are very devout is they fast the day before Purim to represent the fact that Esther fasted before she goes in before the king. But she agrees to go into him. She's not been in there in quite a while. And so we see both remorse and determination. Chapter 5, then, I think, is really relayed by request and delay. She requests to have a feast. And by the way, I'd love for Haman to come. Oh, that'd be good. So they come to that feast, and what happens? She's like, I'm not going to tell you what I want. I got another feast tomorrow, and I'd like for Haman to come to that one too. Oh boy. I love this story. It's amazing. So there's a request and a delay, and of course we know what takes place eventually. In chapter 6, then, we see a reward and a destitution. The layout of all this is the king can't sleep, coincidentally, right? And he brings the scrolls and coincidentally gets to the exact part of the scroll where Mordecai is told, hey, he saved your life. Oh, what did we ever do for him? I don't know. I don't think anything's been done. It's not recorded. Who's standing out there? Haman. Oh, tell him to come in. What would you say if somebody wanted to honor you? What would you do? Of course, the king's talking about me, so he lavishes it all, right? Yeah, go do that to Mordecai. He was coming to ask the king to kill Mordecai. Don't you, if you say the Bible's boring, you hadn't been reading this book. There is no other mystery novel like this one. I mean, the plot thickens, right? It's like, oh boy. Can you imagine Haman walking around the city, declaring how great the guy is on the horse, the very guy he hates, his guts? And everybody in the palace is going, you're the guy who wants to kill him. This is not going to go well for you, pal. Nope, it's sure not. And he's realizing that. Reward and destitution. Chapter 7, I think we see a revealing and a discipline. It takes place there. Eventually, of course, we know that Esther reveals, hey, there's a person that wants to kill all my people. Oh, by the way, I'm Jewish. Apparently, up to this point, the king did not even know that. But oh boy, does Haman know this is not good. And the king said, well, I don't know who this is, but I'd like you to tell me. He's sitting right next to you. Really, really interesting how that takes place. Chapter 8, we see both a recall and a delight. What happens? Get these messengers back out there. Tell the Jews this was a plot. It's very interesting because of the law of the Medos and Persians. They couldn't change it. They could only lay a law over top of it. So the king couldn't rescind the order. He just had to tell the Jews, okay, you're allowed to defend yourself now. But that has got to get out, and it's got to get out quickly. And so that takes place. in chapter 8. Chapter 9, we see both a rivalry and a death as these people begin to defend themselves, and thousands of people lose their lives. And then the short chapter at the end is chapter 10, is both a recording and a declaration. It talks about how great Mordecai was and some of the things that the king does and how his greatness is recorded for us in various chronicles of the kings of the Medes and Persians. So, wonderful story as God unfolds all this for us. Number four, I'd like for us to just quickly, and the Lord is going to surely add this to it too, and I'm not saying these are individual messages because we'll see how God does, but let me just give you some things that we're planning to study. And remember, what we're going to generally do is look at the book from a topical standpoint. So we'll work through the book, but we're going to look at it as a topic. We're planning to look at topics such as sowing and reaping. It'd be hard to tell this story without that principle, wouldn't it? Leadership. How do people lead? And what's the difference with them? I think it's very interesting. One of the things that's striking in this book is the people that Haman was leading. Because remember, he's in control. I mean, he's under the king. He's second in command. When they find out, when Esther reveals that Haman is the guy, do you notice how quickly the servants put a hood over his head and suggest they hang him immediately? That probably gives you a little indication about what kind of leader he was. He wasn't a very loved guy because they're very quick to put the hood on and go, oh, by the way, there's a gallows out there. Would you like us to hang him now? The king says, yep. And buddy, he's gone. I mean, it's like, wow. I think we learned some things about leadership from this. One of the most interesting story or subject lines that I think we'll deal with in this book is the idea of emotions. This book is chocked full of emotion. All kinds. I mean, up and down, you've got it. And I think it'll be really interesting as we look at that. We're going to look at the principle of appeal. What happens when you're appealing to an authority that has power, and how do we deal with that, and what's right to do there? We'll look at the subject of pride. Haman had just a little bit of that, didn't he? The truth is, the king had some of that too. I think it's pretty obvious in chapter 1 that he regretted firing Vashti as quickly as he did. Obviously, we can't study the book without looking at God's sovereignty, how he orchestrates all of that together. And one of kind of the underlying messages of the book that I'm looking forward to looking at is the importance of communication. Imagine how the story could have been different if communication would have broken down in a number of areas. Like, for instance, what would have happened if the men who were tasked to record the good deeds in the book didn't? For Mordecai. What if that had not happened? What happened if someone wrote out the document that was supposed to tell the Jews it's okay to defend yourself? What if they had not written that outright? What if the servant had not communicated explicitly what was happening in the palace, both to Esther and... communication becomes a really important part of this book as well. And then the last one for now, I believe God's going to add to this, but for now that I know we're going to deal with, is the subject of courage. What kind of courage it took, particularly with Esther. I think there was some courage in some other areas too, but particularly for Esther. And the very courage to walk into that house to begin with, let alone to go present herself before the king after 30 days. And all that she laid out there, I think, is a really fascinating idea. And then, of course, we've already touched on this, but God orchestrates timing and people for his purposes. Sometimes we get to be front row observers or participants in what God's doing. And sometimes we're totally in the dark, but he's working. We forget that there are a lot of people in this story that didn't know a lot that was happening. You recognize that there was a gap between memo 1 and memo 2. And those Jews were totally in the dark. All over the kingdom, 127 provinces, they got this decree. We don't know how long it was. They're totally in the dark. Do you think there were some prayer meetings happening in those Jewish homes to deliver them? I think there were. And God was working, but they didn't know it. They had no clue what was happening. They had no clue that Esther was one of their own. They had no clue that all that was orchestrating for her to present this petition before the king. They would eventually know that, but they didn't know the beginning. God is sovereign, and He's working. He's working in our lives, too, and we can't see it. There's times when it's like, Lord, I wish I knew what was going on, but I'm totally in the dark here. I know you are. It doesn't mean I'm not working. And we can see that from the book as well. So, over the next few weeks, specifically as we begin this study, would you just take some time to read the book a couple of times? It won't take you long. Dale told me that in his regular schedule of reading, he came on the book of Esther. What was it this week, Brother Dale, did you tell me? Monday you started it. And he said, you know, I knew this series was starting, and so I was heightened, and I had some questions in there that I don't think I'd have thought about before. So I just want to just take the time, maybe when you're driving, listen to it on your phone or whatever, or read it around the table. It's a fun story to read, and doesn't take you that long, but it'll heighten you as you look at it and think about some of these things and think about, ooh, look at that emotion right there or whatever. And if you come up with a great outline, you could send it to me. That'd be great too. I wouldn't mind that a bit. All right. So I'm looking forward to this study, and I hope this kind of just lays a foundation for you that will help us as we move through the book. So comments or questions? We got about 2 minutes before we need to dismiss. Anybody? Yes, Brother Dale. Sure, absolutely. They had choices in that. Yeah, I think he's just using that as an illustration, not necessarily saying that they didn't have a choice in the matter. Someone else? Comment? Yes, Brother Jeremiah. Right. Right, that's right. Right, yeah, we get the hindsight look at it. Even the idea, you just think about the idea of how many young women do you think were pulled into this process? It said they came from all over the kingdom. So any good-looking girl from all over the kingdom is the idea that you get there. Okay, it could have been lots of them. And yet, even in that, he chooses Esther out of the whole process. It's just really pretty amazing as God orchestrates for that. And God chose to even record it and preserve it for us so that we could see even that process there. So, someone else? Maybe one more question or comment? Anyone? Yes. Oh. Sure. Yeah, and it is interesting that, and I've thought too, the very idea that her cousin, who's her caretaker now, comes and says, by the way, you need to apply for this. And she's like, I don't want to live in the palace. I don't know what else she said, but I can imagine what must have been going through her mind as well in the process. It's really, the whole thing is rather intriguing. I think it'll be fun to do that. But John? We don't, that it does. We don't have that, as far as I know, at this point. But something interesting about a lot of ancient kingdoms is they didn't record things that they failed at. They typically just recorded the good things about themselves. And so unless there was someone else recording it, in this case, God did, then we wouldn't even probably have a record. In other words, the Persians probably aren't going to say, oh, by the way, we tried to kill a bunch of Jews and they actually killed a bunch of us. That just by their very nature, they didn't do that typically. A lot of ancient civilizations didn't do that. They didn't record the negative things that happened in their thing. Which, by the way, tells us how amazing the Word of God is, because God doesn't hide the ugliness of men in the stories. Even the quote-unquote heroes of the Bible, many times we see that. So as far as I know at this point, there's nothing recorded historically that points to that.